Greetings, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This week, I interview Rich LaMonica. And Rich grew up in Jersey City and was the youngest of four kids, and they grew up in a railroad apartment. But the thing you need to know about Rich is that he's been a fighter his entire life. He's worked hard for everything that he's achieved. And Rich tells a story a little bit later in this podcast that really does demonstrate what kind of a fighter he is, how unstoppable he is, how an injury during wartime, that didn't stop him at all. He spent 22 years in the Army, honing his leadership and people skills, and now he mentors those who need help in life through the Misfit Nation LLC. He's a motivational speaker, and he's a host of the award-winning Misfit Nation show. I loved my conversation with him. He's got a master's from Georgetown, and he's pursuing a doctorate from Liberty University. He's absolutely unstoppable. And really, Rich's life these days is all about bringing enlightenment, bringing information, bringing joy to those who listen to his show. My conversation with Rich was really fun. And I think you'll hear that when you listen to the episode. And to be honest, I didn't know what to expect when we started talking. But after a while, I realized, this guy is groovy. And I hope you agree too. So now, this very next episode of Bite-Sized Blessings.
I said, this is my fourth time. I'm playing with fire. I'm playing with that roulette wheel. There's no way I'm coming back. I get into Afghanistan. We go through our little brain processing, get to my combat outpost, and we get ambushed on a patrol. We come back. They start firing mortars at us. We make it through that. I count my guys. Everyone's good. We talk to them. And my medic says, hey, Sergeant, I want to talk to you. So good. We went outside. Sergeant, I was able to save these guys. It's my first time in combat, and I was able to save these guys. I said, that's awesome, Calderon. I pat him on the shoulder. Bam. I said, good job, brother. And there was an explosion right behind me. My elevator pitch would be, I am the son of an Italian dad, Irish mom. Joined the military, served for 22 years in the United States Army, retired, took a year to transition to to become an adult again. And now I'm working hard. I work for the government now. I train soldiers. I'm an author and a podcast host.
Wow. And I would love to know, was that something that you thought of joining the Army ever since you were a kid? Or is that something that kind of, okay, so you're saying you're nodding your head, yes.
Yes, definitely. When I was little, my dad used to sit with my dad and watch a little 13-inch TV, black and white, you know, in the living room. And it was either like the end of Vietnam we were watching on the news or something that was happening in the Middle East. And I was like, it looks so much fun to be a soldier, Dad. I can go play Army all day long. And these guys look like they're having so much fun. He'd always say, no, they're not having fun. Because he was in the Army just before Vietnam. And I was, it has to be fun. Look at it. All that was fun. So that was the only thing in my head forever was to join the Army.
And I love that your dad was saying, it's not that much fun, but it sounds like you did not care.
I did not. And it didn't dawn on me that he really didn't want me to join until after my junior year of high school. I was a November baby. So I started school kind of early compared to everyone else. So I was younger than everyone. So after junior year, I went to the recruiter's office and he said, your dad has to sign, let you in. I said, okay, my dad will sign. He's a patriot. He'll do that. I went home and said, no, enough of us have served. You got to go to college. I said, whoa, I haven't done anything to go to college. I've taken shop classes. I've done all the mess around classes in school. He said, well, we'll figure it out. You'll do that your senior year. So my whole senior year, instead of having a year off, basically, I had multiple Englishes, multiple sciences, extra math in order to get to college. and take my SAT and pass somehow and get into college.
And so did you end up actually going to college?
I did actually go to college. I went to Berkeley College in New York for a year and then three semesters at St. Peter's College in New Jersey. I played college football there for two seasons. And then I finally said, Dad, you can't stop me now. I'm joining.
Wow. Okay. Well, what did your mom think about all this?
She hated it 100%. I joined. I was her baby. I was the youngest. My older brother, he joined the Navy right out of high school. He did 6 years and she thought that would be the last one that joined. And she knew I was a dirty kid. I went across the street, played in the mud all the time, played Army all the time, but she didn't think it would fester into anything different, anything other than just me playing. And when I joined, she cried, of course. And when I actually left, she cried. My first duty station, I couldn't write her right away because I didn't know anything. I was trying to figure out where to put my hands, how to do things. And she got worried. We got sent to the field and I was in California in the desert and she sent a Red Cross message looking for me. And they told her where I was and she sent me a Christmas tree out there. And I was made fun of for a while by my peers and my first sergeant. I had to carry his Christmas tree on the plane with me. But I kept that Christmas tree for the rest of my career.
I love that. I mean, she loved you and she missed you. And you were the baby of the family. Yes. So she's like the baby.
He's finally leaving, but he's left.
Yes. But how sweet to give you a Christmas tree. And I bet everyone was actually secretly jealous.
Possibly.
Yeah, that they were making fun of you. They were super jealous. We all know. Now, did you even plan to spend 22 years in the Army? Was that,
No, not at all. That wasn't in the cards at all. I thought I'd do maybe one term, two terms, and then find my niche somewhere else, maybe become a police officer, a firefighter in my local community. But then I met the love of my life in my first duty station. And she's like, you're not becoming a cop. You're not doing this. You're already doing something dangerous. You don't need to do something else dangerous. So met her. We had our daughter. And that's when I started raising my right hand more to reenlist. And I stayed in until my daughter graduated high school.
Oh, wow. And I am curious, has it afforded you the ability to live in a bunch of different places all over the world?
Yes. So we lived all around the country and then the three of us got to stay in South Korea for 2 years.
Because that's really just speaking as a kid who grew up overseas.
Yeah.
You know, just moving and living overseas, but even just moving to different places within the U.S., you just meet so many people and you have so many experiences. And you and I have talked about this before, but you kind of understand that the world is a big place.
Yes. Huge place. And that's why I was glad on my last tour to Korea, I was able to bring my wife and daughter. I think my daughter was in, I say, fourth, fifth grade when we went over there. So when we left, she was going into sixth grade when we left there. And so her eyes opened. She thought everything was so hard in the United States. Everything was so bad. And then I said, this is going to open your eyes to what really bad is and what other kids in the world go through on a daily basis. Once you've seen that those little kids in Korea, they wake up, get that little bowl of rice. They go to school when it's dark. They get on the bus by themselves, go on a train by themselves, go to school all day, get off out of school, go to an art. So either taekwondo, karate, music or something, come home late, get another little bowl of rice, go to bed and repeat every day. And there she was complaining that she didn't get a happy meal. So after that, she was no more complaining about little things and seeing that more world view at that time.
Okay, I have to tell you, I'm so intrigued that your father was Italian and your mother was Irish. How did they meet?
Funny story is they lived about a block from each other. They didn't like each other growing up. So my dad lived on a Jefferson. She lived on, I think it was Baldwin Avenue, like right here. So it was just an L away from each other. And they didn't like each other. My dad was like that greaser. She was like that posh and or vice versa. And they would not, their circles didn't mix until he went to the Army, came back and his friends like, you want to go to this political rally? I guess like some speech or something. And you can go out. My cousin's going to be with me. So she was the cousin. And from that point on, they fell in love. And then 50 years later, they were still married until my mom died in 2019.
Oh, I'm sorry about the loss of your mother. I'm so sorry. But that's a pretty romantic story. I have to say, just from my perspective, it's pretty romantic. And of course, it reminds me of the show Grease, right? Yes. The movie Grease. I mean, 100%. It's like,
and that's how I always looked at them. Is that character playing that was them 100%. She was the beauty dropout and he was the greaser. So
that's fabulous. But what an interesting kind of, your family tree is probably pretty fascinating because you've got all this Irish on one side and then you have all this Italian on the other side. Yes. So you sound primarily European. Your family sounds like they all come from Europe. Is that true?
According to 23andMe, I have heritage into Africa. So in Sicily, so many people conquered Italy over the years. So your roots come from whatever conquering culture came through there. So there's a lot of different cultural background from those who live in Italy and are like our family. My grandfather, my dad's father, his family started in the mainland in Calabria, got kicked out of the mainland, went to Sicily, got kicked out of Sicily, went to Argentina, and then moved to the United States. So it was kind of a weird thing like this. And so he had all that stuff mixed in. Then my grandmother's family is from Naples, so not far from Calabria. And so you have some of the same mixtures. And then she wound up as an orphan in Connecticut. And she got adopted. I don't know if it was by family or just friends of the family, moved to Hoboken, New Jersey, grew up with Frank Sinatra. So there's all this kind of mixture of stuff. And then they met each other in New Jersey, got married, fell in love, and they stayed together forever too.
Okay. So this is probably not a fair question, but which is your favorite type of food? Italian food or food from Ireland?
I'd go 100% Italian.
Yes. I was going to say, me too. Yeah. There's just something about pizza and pasta that you kind of just can't get over that. It's just like too perfect.
And having just got back from Italy a couple weeks ago, I'd have to say, yes, it's amazing.
Is it? Oh, I bet it's even better over there.
100%.
I'm so jealous. Now I'm jealous. Well, you know, my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? And I'm doubly intrigued just based on your mother and your father's kind of where they've come from. So I'm so interested in the answer.
We were raised a Roman Catholic, all of us. They were both Catholic. They actually both went to the same, ironically went to the same church growing up and didn't talk to each other. And then we were all raised Catholic. And then, of course, when you get older, you do what you want. But we also raised my wife converted to Catholicism. My daughter was raised Catholic until she got older and went and did her own thing as well.
I have to say, I dated a Catholic gentleman for 5 years and I lived in Portland, Oregon. And Portland has the most gorgeous, oh my gosh, the archdiocese is there. And so the Grand Cathedral is in Portland and it is so beautiful. It's just mind-blowing. And the art and the decoration and the smells, it just smells so good, like wax and candles and just scent and incense. But then you're there and you're in this massive building. It's so ridiculously beautiful. And of course, when people sing, it sounds like a choir of angels, even if everyone's a terrible singer. And so there was just something about just that space, being in that space, not being Catholic, but just loving I love the liturgy because I knew every time what was going to happen. It became very, I don't know, good for me. It was very comfortable. There was a lot of consolation in it every time. And it, you know, my ex wanted to be a priest at one time, but then he decided to serve outside of the priesthood. And so every once in a while, he'd teach me something new. And my favorite thing he taught me was at the end of each day, he would say, "All right, what was your desolation for today?" And so that meant the thing that made me like the saddest or the worst thing that happened. And then he'd say, all right, what was the consolation? And I, you know, we would both talk about our consolations, but it really made me kind of reflect on the day and kind of put a button or a cherry on the top of the day. In this really gorgeous, sacred way. And so I have a lot of affection for Catholicism. I think it's an incredibly beautiful, beautiful liturgy and way of worship.
Well, I agree. And I mean, I've been to many other, faiths and faith-based religions, and I still go back to mine. I know you can practice in all of them and not go against God. So you know, where some people believe you do, if you go to a different church, but you can go anywhere, you can pray to bow to Buddha, do meditation, and still go back to God the next day and say, hey, look, I had my meditation yesterday. I'm back with you, brother. And he's all right. So.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, in Portland also, they have this old Episcopal Gothic church that is the opposite kind of the Catholic church, because it's made of these big, dark black granite pieces. So it's kind of looks like a castle. Right. And once a month, they would have this Taizé service. And are you familiar with what Taizé is? And so, Well, basically, they train and anoint these lay healers. And then everyone can come to this service. It usually starts at 5. Being Portland, it's usually dark and raining by 5. And so you're in this dark church, lit by candles in the worship space, and all these people come, I mean, to be healed. And then all these people sit out in the pews, and you just sing the same kind of, you sing a lot of different hymns, but you sing them over and over again so that it becomes a chant. And then after a while, people can go up and there's a laying of hands. But I saw some of the most beautiful, beautiful, like an elderly man helping his wife who could barely walk up to the front. And it was, I didn't go there for healing. I went there to be supportive. I wasn't Episcopal either. You see this? It makes me sound like I creep on other churches and I hang out at all these places. But yeah, I'm creeping up on everybody. But it was really cool and important to be in that space and kind of be of service in that way, to just be present for these people who needed help. And so I'm right there with you. It doesn't, you know, you can meditate, you can even go on a nature hike, or you can go to a Catholic service or whatever that looks like. And it can be your sacred space for that moment. You can still go back to what you love and what really resonates for your heart. Just for my own edification, like in the Army, how does that work? Do they have different like clergy or how does that work there?
They do have a pretty much every denomination they have. I mean, now they even have a Sikh practitioner. They have all kinds of practitioners now. So like when I was overseas in combat, it was hard to find that Catholic priest to come. So you get them like maybe once a month, because there was only one maybe in theater or two maybe in theater, and they had to rotate to every base. So you might get them once a month, but everyone else would have multiple and they'd be able to have it every week. So you're real happy when that guy or gal came to pray with you and just hang out with you, that one day you can breathe a little differently.
No way. Yeah, I had no idea. That's actually really fascinating. Because hospitals have chaplains and they're usually there all the time, you know, because the chaplain, that's their job. They go to the hospital or they go to the care unit. That's their job. And they visit with people everywhere, all throughout the hospital. And I know, you know, of course, in MASH, I'm dating myself. Did you ever watch MASH?
Yes, I did.
Did you watch MASH? That's totally dating myself. They had a chaplain, you know, on the show, but it kind of seemed like the chaplain was always there. And so yeah. I didn't know if that was the case for you as well. But it sounds like it was more of a once of a month kind of thing.
Mostly for the Catholicism side, but like most units have a chaplain assigned to them now. Like most battalion level have a chaplain assigned. So in my last unit on Fort Campbell, we had Chaplain Sheets, and his office was right behind mine. But he was a Christian chaplain, not Catholic, but he was right behind me. I can go to him and mess with him all day and talk to him and then go back to my office. And we had a good relationship. He was a great man. He still is a great man.
That's so funny. I kind of like the idea of you just popping into his office and giving him a hard time. That's so great. I mean, I think to do that job, you have to have a sense of humor, you know, because you're going to like see things or experience things or what have you. And I think having a sense of humor just in general in this world is so necessary, you know, because I think, you know, you and I have talked before, but I mean, I think having a sense of humor is a superpower, and you seem like you have an incredible sense of humor. Is that from your parents? Is it just in you? Is it in your family?
I think it comes from both my parents. My mom is real. She was probably the harder of the two. She was more of the tough one. And dad kind of kept things even keyed and made us laugh a lot more. But yeah, I got it from both of them. Mom, when she wanted us to laugh, she made us laugh. But when she wanted us to be disciplined, we were disciplined. So.
And I would love to know what was kind of one of your favorite memories of being in the Army?
In the Army, 22 years, a lot of good memories. I think my favorite memory would probably be my first time going to Korea and getting off the plane, and you didn't get off into a terminal back then. You got off onto the tarmac and it was hot, and you walk out there and you smell the rice fields, rice paddies. And it's horrible because you know what's in a rice paddy. It's feces and whatever else they can put in there. You find that and you're about to let everything out right away. And then all of a sudden there's a hand on your shoulder. Don't worry, brother. It gets better. And that's the whole military career. Something always gets better. And I mean, there's so many great moments when things just succeed at in life. Things that you succeed in the military, missions that you're a success, are all great. So narrowing down to one is hard, but one moment like that is something that sticks out to me.
And I know you have your own podcast called The Misfit Nation. Yes. And I mean, did you, when you came back after, I mean, like, how did this come about? How did you decide I want to do this?
Well, the podcast came about during our friend COVID. So in 2020, when everyone was looking for other things to do, since everything was not there for them anymore, I just finished my master's degree at Georgetown. I couldn't walk across the stage, so I was kind of mad about that. But I also realized I had about 8 hours a week that were not dedicated to anything anymore. I didn't have to study anymore. So I had 8 empty hours. I told my wife, I got to find something to do. I'm going to just go crazy here. So I started researching with fun things to do, and I found podcasting. Joe Rogan can do it. I can do it. He's a comedian. God, I can do it. So I called my old soldiers and asked them if I can use the name, because this is the name of our platoon, the Misfits. And they said, yeah, do it. And so I said, thank you for that. I want you to be my first guest on the show. So for my first three or four shows was all people I knew to get my feet wet and understand what I was doing, interview them. Then I interviewed a few more veterans. I just want to get their stories out, to get that pressure off their chest, so they'd stay with us a little longer, wouldn't become part of the statistic of 22 a day the VA says, or the actual 44 a day to commit suicide. And it was going great. And then they called me back and said, look, it's great to have us tell our story, but we need to learn other stuff. We need other experts to come on and help us. I said, challenge accepted. So I just started reaching out on Podmatch, and bam, everyone started coming on. Authors, entrepreneurs, healers, everyone that wants to talk and help people came on now. Like I told you, episode 417, I think I just recorded. So it's going pretty well.
Well, I mean, yes, it is going really well, because you know that as we're in the podcasting world, that it's, first of all, a miracle if you reach 1 year, right, where you're consistently putting out content. But then B, if you even finish one season or go beyond even 5 episodes. I didn't know that. Yeah. I didn't know that most podcasts quit after 5, 6, 7 episodes, because I think, you know, someone today said, oh my gosh, I listened to your podcast and the production is so great. How many people do you have working for you? And I started laughing and I was like, I'm sorry, what? I was like, I do everything. And they were like, no. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I don't, am I made of money? No, I don't know who you think I am, or do you think I'm making money? No. I do everything from soup to nuts, production, direction, you know, get hustling, hustle. The hustle is real, people. And they just couldn't believe it. And I thought to myself, you know, when I first started, and I'm sure you felt this way too, it was overwhelming because the learning curve is so steep. But then you get a groove, right? You get in a groove and it gets better. And it gets easier. But also for you, knowing that you're putting this content out, this show out, that is helping other people in the armed services and people who aren't in the armed services anymore, you know, things that they need to hear or to feel inspired. They need inspiration. They need ratification that their choices were right. They need assurance that they're going to be okay. So that must help you to no end, that you know that you're helping them.
Definitely. And one of the things that hurts a lot of veterans when they get out is they don't have a purpose anymore. They don't have that, hey, I got to do this all day. By doing this, it's kind of, I'm helping them, but I'm also helping me. Because I have found my purpose. My purpose is to get people's stories out there, to get your story out there, to get everyone's story out there, but also to let that story resonate with at least one person. So if me and you talking today resonates with one person and their day is better, we have succeeded. And that's the same way I look at my show. If I help one person on every show, that's 415 people I just helped. And I think that's a victory right there. So that's awesome.
That's amazing. I really love that. And I do think it is. I mean, I don't know how much, I certainly read the news, not too much, so I don't get too totally depressed, but just being aware of what is happening for those who, you know, retire from the military, and those statistics that you were talking about earlier. I read these stories and I just get so, I'm first of all perplexed and confused, and then I get angry because I think to myself, WTF, why is this even happening? And then I think, who is not paying attention here? Like, what? How can we fix this? How can we fix this? And I think they're trying, but it's a long road, apparently.
It became an uphill climb because for a while, like in my early years, if you went to any medical help, you were deemed as broken or weak. So a lot of us didn't go get help for anything. You didn't want to get perceived as that. It wasn't until even after my 2010-11 deployment to Afghanistan, I lost my first soldier in combat on December 31st, 2010. And that raid, that weighs on your head, weighs on your chest. But I had to get my whole platoon home. I had to make sure they didn't wind up on CNN for doing something else. So I pushed all them to do the right thing. And by doing that was helping me. But by the time I was coming home, we had to go through this little, it's called a, I guess, reverse it, a reintegration training. And you got to go through all these stations, medical training, all medical stations. I went to the doc. I said, look, I need help. My head's not right. I can finally admit that it's me that's the problem. It's not my wife and daughter. They didn't change. I changed. I need help. He looked at me and said, you're a non-commissioned officer. You're a leader. Go back to work. I said, okay. So that was 2011. I didn't really get help for my mental health until 2016. And that's part of the problem. Because of the perception of what you looked like if you went to get help. So a lot of people would not get help. And then if you were a leader, you shouldn't get help because you have to lead soldiers. So a lot of those guys and gals would get out and know that if they went to get help, it's wrong. So they wouldn't get help. They wouldn't tell people something was wrong. And the next thing they know, we don't have them anymore.
I am so sorry, and I just want to say that I can't believe that.
It was shocking.
Partially because I grew up in a family where my mother was all about mental health. And like, if we needed to go to see a therapist or whoever, a social worker, whatever we felt, a counselor, if we felt like we needed it, it was there, like done. But I mean, I'm lucky. I think for a lot of people, and apparently even since recently, the United States government, that's not a good thing or a normal thing. It's heartbreaking. That these human beings, these individuals who have given so much, dedicated so much of their life to helping other people, to being of service to our country, are being told that they can't get access to the care that they need, or that they shouldn't, I guess, in some cases. You know, I mean, that makes me a little crazy.
it's much better today for today's soldier, today's service member. It is flipped kind of. They're told to go get help. They're even the leaders are told to get help now. They have human dynamics people in every battalion basically. So work on their mental, physical, and overall health. So everything is bottled into one to make sure they are a complete person and a complete soldier warrior now, instead of just worrying about being able to shoot, move, communicate. Now, can they do that plus also live a normal life? And that's the main focus now. So they all have those check-ins, check-outs now, check-ups to make sure everything's okay and make sure they can make it to the next day, the next life, the next chapter of their life.
Okay, I'm going to throw a little question in here for you that might stump you a little bit, but thought I'd just throw it in there. They're doing some really fascinating research on soldiers and PTSD with entheogens, plant medicines, mushrooms, that kind of stuff, that's showing that it can cure or help alleviate the PTSD. Do you know anything about it, and how do you feel about that?
I've had a couple guests on the show who have tried mushrooms, or they've tried ketamine and things like that. You know, they went to, I guess it's South America where it's legal to do things and try them. And they all rave about it. Me, I told the doctor at the VA when they finally wanted to help me, I don't want any medication. I said, just give me the tools to make it through this. Give me the tools I need to get through this. I don't need drugs, because I've seen the people that were in the VA walk around looking like zombies. I didn't want that. I don't want that for anybody. So I said, give me the tools and I'll make myself better. And I finally got EMDR and that helped me. But there's like, that worked for me. Other things might work for other people. I'm never going to say don't do it, because it might work for you. We might keep you with us. If that's what it takes to keep you with us, go ahead to try mushrooms, try ketamine, try whatever it is that makes you stay whole and stay with us.
And I'm right there with you with EMDR being completely magical and this kind of, just mystifying practice. I had this belief system or this story in my head that I'd had my whole life and I had no idea where it came from. And my therapist one day said, let's try some EMDR. And she did it like two visits, because I was seeing her once a week. So 1 week and then the next week. And by gosh, about 2 weeks later, all of a sudden, this memory surfaced, this original memory of, and I was like, oh my God, that's where that story comes from. And it was from when I was 4 years old. Wow. I mean, EMDR is astonishing with what it can do.
Yes. And if you let it work. So just like anything, you have to be part of it. So you can't just sit there and say, okay, doc, yeah, let's do this, blah, blah, blah. You're saying these big words, make me do these things. You have to, like, you let yourself go for those visits. I went to Dr. King Counts here in town. He was a civilian practitioner, because I kind of got escorted out of the VA one time. So they made me go to civilians. So I went to the civilians, and he was my godsend. He turned that switch on me, and I went from going down that path to darkness to now pushing everyone else into the light. Something that really changed my life. I was, like I just told you about, going to the darkness and such like that. On my last official deployment, it was my fourth deployment. Most of my friends who died on their third or fourth deployment. So in my head, I said, I made it through three. There's no way I'm making through four. So going into it, I was negative Nancy the whole time. I said, I'm going to die. I won't see you guys when I come back. I told my platoon, I said, this is the last time you're going to see me. I'm not coming home. You're going to be carrying me. Sergeant, you're just ain't you. And Sergeant Chantel Watts at the time, Chantel coming now, coming then, Watts now, I'm sorry. She said, Sergeant, that's not you. Get that out of your head. Stop talking like that. You're way better than this. I was like, nah, this is my fourth time. I'm playing with fire. I'm playing with that roulette wheel. There's no way I'm coming back. I get into Afghanistan. We go through our little brain processing, get to my combat outpost, and we get ambushed on a patrol. We come back. They start firing mortars at us. We make it through that. I count my guys. Everyone's good. We talk to them. And my medic says, hey, Sergeant, I want to talk to you. So good. We went outside. Sergeant, I was able to save these guys. It's my first time in combat, and I was able to save these guys. I said, that's awesome, Calderon. I pat him on the shoulder. Bam. I said, good job, brother. And there was an explosion right behind me. The mortar hit behind us and went through my leg, out the front, and missed him completely. That was my wake up call. That's what it took to let me know that I have a life worth living. They tried to take me out, and my favorite song is Rooster by Alice in Chains. I said they came to get the rooster and they missed. That was their one chance. That's the only chance they're getting. And that was my eye opener, my miracle day. I called my wife from the operating right before I went to operation. I said, look, we're getting into that license plate where we talked about the free one. What? Ah! So I'm alive. And she hung up. I had to get the medic to dial again. We did it again. Then after I came out of anesthesia, I talked to her, talked to my parents, and they all said the same thing. You should have never been negative going in. And from that day on, I was forward thinking, positive thinking, everything's going to be all right. And that made everything much better.
I totally understand how on your third and fourth deployment, you would feel like you're playing with fire, that you're putting yourself back out there, that roulette wheel is spinning and the luck's going to run out. I totally understand that. But still, you kept going back, and you must have been just... Was it because you believed in the mission so fiercely, or you didn't want to leave your people, or you love the Army? What? Why did you keep going back?
A combination of all this. So my third deployment, I came from Korea, the 2-year Korea trip. I came back to the States. I was only home 60 days and I went to war. My platoon was already there. I never met them before. So I met them in combat. I was the Misfits. I met them there. We created an awesome bond, and we lost Sergeant Michael Beckerman on December 31st, 2010. And that's where the bond really got even stronger when we lost him. And from that point, it was, like I said before, I kept them all together, but I had this anger in me at the Taliban and all everyone else in the world I was mad at. And so when they came up, the next deployment was to be advisors. I volunteered. I said, I'm going. Even though I knew it was my fourth deployment and all that bad stuff could happen, I raised my hand and said, I'm going. I said, send me. And let my platoon, one of my squad leaders took over the platoon. I went to the advisor role and did that. So patriotism, served my brother and sister. And then the last one was kind of payback, revenge tour. And it kind of bit me when I got that negative thoughts in my head. But then when it hit me, the positivity came out and everything worked out in the end.
And I would, you know, I'm sure you were whisked off to have an operation to take care of your injury. And then do you come back to the States to recover, or how does that work?
They wanted me to. They wanted me to go to Germany and go back to the States. I said, no, I got to get back into the fight. Got to get back out there. So they put me on crutches. I got on this old Russian helicopter and flew back to my base within 32 hours.
What?
Yes. And the first time I was ever on crutches in my life too. And I'm walking with crutches, my weapon hanging down on rocks, trying to walk on crutches, looking like a very special person, and getting on the helicopter. And no one's helping me either. No one helps you get on the helicopter. I'm trying to wedge through that little door to get in there and just throw my crutches on and kind of crawl up and go, so let's go back into the combat.
Oh my God. I did you say less than 32 hours
after? It was about 31 hours and 45 minutes till the helicopter came back.
Wow, that's a hell of a turnaround time.
Yeah.
And then you go back to be with your platoon.
My team,
yeah. Your team. And then presumably you heal while you're on the crutches, I guess?
Yes. Okay. I got rid of one crutch right away. I couldn't stand them. So I used one just basically as a cane kind of. And for a while, I didn't do enough. And my knee kind of exploded, kind of got real big with the lethargic movement. So I started sneaking out against everyone's wishes to go to we had a treadmill. I'd go there at 3 a.m. and walk until I can run, then run while no one was around, and get back into my bed before anyone got up and say, go have a good workout and wait till they come back. And then we'd go eat and do our meetings until I was cleared to do stuff.
Okay, what? you're kind of unstoppable. Oh my God. I can't believe this story. I just, look, if that would have happened to me, I would have laid in bed as long as humanly possible. Partially because I love bed, but also partially because, you know, my mother beat it into my head. When you get really injured, you know, when I was young, you have to rest. You need to lay in bed and rest.
What's that chicken noodle soup?
Yes. But you did not. Well, you rested for 31 hours and 45 minutes, I guess.
And then a couple of days after I got back to our combat outpost, my medic would make sure I stayed there and he'd bring me my food. Wouldn't even let me out of my hooch. And it was me and my team leader. So team leader, team sergeant stayed in the same room. And he'd check on me, make sure I wasn't leaving. He'd make sure I went, made sure I'd showered so the room wouldn't stink. So he made me sure I went to the shower, came back. But after I got bored, I said, I can't do this. I got to be out there with my guys. I can't have them out there doing things I'm telling them to do without me doing it. So I started working out and everything worked out well.
Okay. Yeah. My jaw is still dropped. I can't believe this. You're astonishing. Do you have any, I mean, how is your leg these days?
Oh, it's telling me I should have went and got help these days, but it makes a lot of good noises in the morning, has some good clicking noises, and it yells at me every once in a while, but I still try to do stuff on it. It does. I still yell back at it.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I'm sorry. You're just kind of astonishing. So, thank you for telling that story. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm still going to be thinking about this. I can tell when I go to bed tonight because it's just so shocking to me. Do you have any other stories that you would like to share? Any other stories? No pressure. I just always ask just to make sure that my guest feels like they've said everything that they want to.
I think I'll go back to Chaplain Sheets. I told you I messed around with him a lot. After my soldier was killed, he was the chaplain, and he seen that we were going through that bad time. And he took his arms and put them around me. He said, look, I'm here for you. So I said, look, get my whole platoon into that chapel. I know some of them are heathens, but get them in there and we'll sit there and let them just vent. Let them vent. That's a good idea, Sergeant. So we went in there and we all just let it all out. Let it out on him. And he said, next, next, next. And by the time he was done, they were ready to go back out and go on patrol without that thought in their head about committing something dumb, but to get through it together for the guy and gal next to you and come home. But it was all thanks to him and his guidance to me. And I guess me working with him together to get through this.
And I think that story also, for me, really emphasizes the love and affection that you felt for your unit, but also that they felt for you that they would do that and for each other.
Yes, they still do now to this day.
I hope you loved this episode of the podcast and my conversation with Rich LaMonica. There will be a link to his website in the episode show notes, so be sure to do a deeper dive and check out what this amazing human being is all about. Thanks so much to all of you who listen every single week. Thanks to those of you who share this podcast with your friends, and thanks to all of you who have written a review or left a rating for this little work of mine. I'm so very grateful to all of you who support the podcast and who give me feedback. You'll never know how much it means to me. And don't forget, there is a YouTube channel. It's really fun. I'm trying to keep this whole project of mine, this thing that I'm putting out into the world, I'm trying to keep it kind of dynamic and creative, and I'm always trying to think of fun things to do to spice it up a little bit, and the YouTube channel is a part of that. So if you want to get a look at any of the guests that I've had on the podcast, head on over to the YouTube channel and you can see them in real life. As well, I hope you're enjoying the bits of beauty that I include at the end of every episode show notes. They're just little nuggets of information I think everyone should know, and nuggets of information that I think and I hope illustrate so very deeply that this world is a gorgeous and glorious place. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Rich. Be unstoppable. Rich has really gone through some things. And in the midst of it all, he's had his unit. He's had his friends. He's had those around him who believe in him and support him. So be like Rich and cultivate a community, a coterie of friends who believe in you, who know that you are an incredible human being, that you are here to do good things on this planet, because they will always lift you up. They will always have your back. So be like Rich, have impeccable friends, have impeccable community, and just know that when you do that, I mean, every day you're going to wake up and you're going to know that you are loved. See you next week for the very next episode of the podcast. And until then, I hope your week is filled with joy, with beauty, and meetings with strangers who eventually will become best friends.